Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to The Lob podcast from These Football Times. And in this mini-series called Icons, a number of the team from TFT Towers will be chatting about players, recent or past, who they consider worthy of being described as true icons of the football world. My name is Gary Thacker, and in this episode, I'm chatting with Dave Bowler about one of his footballing icons. Morning, Dave.
Morning, Gary. Looking forward to getting into this.
Good man. Okay, so, buddy, so who are you putting forward in this episode? And before we delve a little deeper into your reasoning, briefly, why do you consider them to be iconic?
It's George Best. And in saying the name George Best, you've answered all your questions, basically. is there a more iconic footballer from the United Kingdom than George Best? I don't think there is. I mean, you can argue Bobby Moore, I suppose, picking up the World Cup or something like that. But, I mean, George Best was everything you wanted a footballer to be. I think he's the greatest player from these islands, certainly in the television era. You could, people will argue about Stanley Matthews and Tom Finney and people like that, but you know, we've only got a very little bit of them on telly, but you know, you can see George Best in action lots and lots of times. So, you know, you can see what his ability was. But he was more than that. I mean, you know, he was the fifth Beatle. It was all the glamour. He kind of took us into the colour television age, George Best, really, I suppose. He was a technical footballer. Everything about George Best was just right for the times. He was that late 60s, early 70s. He was the Mavericks' maverick. You know, he was just the most amazing footballer. And, you know, again, because we've got him on television, you can see the pictures of him and you can see the pitches that he did it on, which, you know, is even more astonishing. So, and for me personally, I mean, I was born in 64. So I think to have an idol, they've got to be older than you are. You can't have idols, you know, that are younger than you. I think that's very, very difficult. I think the people that get to you when you're sort of between, I don't know, 7 or 8 and between maybe 15, they stick with you forever. You know, you have that kind of unconditional love for you know, George Best, Genesis and Kate Bush, and that's about it, really. And then you get to a point sort of beyond that, and, you know, you know what the world's about, and you can see that they're just as, you know, flawed and horrendous as you are. So, but those people that get you early on, you know, I mean, George Best was one of them. For the many things that were wrong with George Best, and, you know, in his personal life and blah blah blah, he's George Best, and that's it. Because, you know, I got him at the right age.
Yeah, it's. I mean, when I saw who we're going to be talking about, and I thought, I'm going to ask Dave to explain why this guy's an icon. He's one of those, it's drop the mic moments, isn't it? It's George Best, drop the mic, walk away, job done. Yeah, okay, so you mentioned about the sort of the era. I mean, unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember him live much as yourself. So what sort of era are we talking about?
I suppose I'm thinking about his debut in 63 against the Albion, funnily enough. And then through, I suppose, I mean, his prime carried on until about 72. And then it was a rapid downhill spiral from there with disappearances and all kinds of things that we've talked about a little bit in other podcasts, particularly in the 70s series. When I think the responsibility of carrying a very ordinary Manchester United team, as it had become, you know, by the time Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law and Pat Creran were packing up, I think the responsibility, George Best didn't do responsibility, really. And I think I think the responsibility of carrying that side was probably too much. And that, you know, along with all these other, you know, well-documented issues, I think that kind of finished him off. But for those sort of, I don't know, 7-8 years, absolutely unbelievable football.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just scanning down the questions I'm going to ask you, and you think each of these questions are going to be, you know, are you having a laugh? I mean, you know, it's so okay. So the first thing is, you know, is any sort of defining seasons or games that sort of epitomise his style or his iconic status? There's several. I know, mate. Pick a few.
I suppose, you know, Benfica '66, and they beat Benfica 5-1. That was one of those moments where he sort of announced himself to the entire world, an amazing performance, tore him apart. And of course, he comes back with a sombrero on and his El Beetle and all of that. And that then starts that sort of element of his career. Obviously, the European Cup final in 68 is a magical moment. The goal and just the way he played throughout. But I think with George Best, it's more, and I suppose particularly now here we are 50 odd years on, whatever it is, it's those moments, isn't it, that you always see on the television. I mean, there's, you'll know the Chelsea game where basically Ron Harris is chasing after him with an axe and he still glides through the entire Chelsea defence and scores a goal. Or that one against Sheffield United where he glides through and knocks it in off the post. Or the six goals at Northampton. I mean, there's just hundreds of them, isn't there? We were blessed that he was on television as much as he was, that we're still able to catch all that. And there was another one as well, and I don't know if you'll remember this, Gary, because I've been looking for this for years. In the school holidays in the early 70s, he had a soccer school series on TV.
George Best Soccer School. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and that's never come out on DVD or VHS or on YouTube or nothing. Yeah. So, and again, that was another one of those things that kind of, at that age, sort of just put him straight in the front of your brain, you know. And nobody else would have done that, would they? You know, it was what he did. He was the one that turned football or footballers into commercial vehicles. I mean, I know Stanley Matthews had done a bit, and Johnny Haynes, the Bill Green boy, and all that sort of stuff. But George Best was the one who took footballers onto another level. He wasn't back page, he was front page, he was every page, you know, and that then changed everything, you know, and all of those ones that came after, you know, the Rodney Marshes and Stan Bowles and all those people. It's kind of built on the foundations of what George Best was, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I remember those games you mentioned. I mean, particularly the Chelsea one, and, you know, Ron Harris, I did catch him a couple of times, caught him, sort of kick him, but I did kick him twice, and he just seemed to just keep going. You know, I mean, Ron Harris doesn't tackle with a feather duster either, you know, and the Northampton won a game. Both those games, I mean, the pitches were like ploughed fields, and there he is, you know, rattling the goals in performances that just, you know, speak of a majesty. You know, I mean, there's some players that sort of rise above, not the mediocre player, but they rise above the great players and onto a plane that's sort of almost exclusive to them. So, yeah, absolutely. Did Best change or redefine the position he played? But he played so many positions as well for United, didn't he? Left, right, centre.
He could play absolutely anywhere. And it's a little bit like, I suppose, the same conversation is like with Messi now, I suppose. Did he change the game? I don't know whether he did, because who the hell else could play like George Best? You know,
yeah, true.
In that sense, he's not, you know, redefining the position or, you know, being the sort of player that can create a new formation, or, you know, it's not like the Hungarians in 53 with a deep line centre forward or where. I mean, George Best could play anywhere because he was just a supremely naturally gifted. He got that. I mean, as you were saying there, with Ron Harris kicking him up the backside, he's still got this incredible balance that he can just keep going and going and going and through the mud and all of that. So in that sense, he didn't redefine it. But as I say, he redefined what a footballer was. I think, you know, he was the one that had the columns in the newspaper or the magazines. He was the one selling you shoes, and he got a boutique, and he was, you know, what's the famous thing about, you know, I spent most of my money on booze and women and the rest of it I squandered. Yeah, that was... I mean, we can argue about in these politically correct times whether this is a good thing to be saying. But back in the 1970s, I mean, it was a rock star. He was, you know, he was Paul McCartney in a football shirt, wasn't he, really? Yeah, that's the easiest way of putting it, I think.
The stories of that, you know, like you mentioned about, you know, spent a lot of money on women and wine, and the rest of the stories are sort of manifold. I remember one, and whether it's true or not, now, we just hope it is. Apparently, it was this hotel penthouse with Miss World, just come back from a casino, there's £5, now it's all over the bed and the champagne. And this guy comes in, this waiter comes in with another bottle of champagne and looks at him. It's George. Where did it all go wrong? Classic. Absolutely classic. I guess. This is going to be quite interesting. A couple of things we're going to talk about now. I mean, there again, how many do you want to answer this way? Any controversies or setbacks And how we angle? How did he angle them? Now, Dave, we could be here for an hour on this one, kiddo.
I mean, I suppose sort of post, I don't know, 69, 70. I mean, it was all setbacks and controversies, wasn't it, really? I mean, that game against Northampton, he'd been banned for about 2 months, hadn't he? Or six weeks.
That's right,
Before that. Obviously, there were the times he went AWOL and Matt Busby was sending search parties out to try and find him. There's a sort of a Gazza element to him, I think. You know, I mean, in the boy who never grew up kind of thing. I think there's a bit of that. And when he, as I say, as Manchester United sort of toppled away from being the best, and Matt Busby disappeared as well, and Wilf McGuinness took over, and then Franco Farrell and whatever. I think he was never the same without Matt Busby as the manager. I think Busby was the one who could, not necessarily control him, but he was the kind of father figure, I suppose.
Yeah, stability.
Somebody he could trust and confide in, and the others weren't that same sort of person. And as I say, having the responsibility of taking over from Dennis Law and Bobby Charlton and carrying that team on his shoulders when they were, Manchester United, we talk about recruitment now. I mean, Manchester United recruitment wasn't the greatest at that time.
No.
So, you know, it all fell on him. And, he's obviously the problems with alcoholism in himself and in his family are well documented. So, I mean, the stresses and strains, he wasn't built for that. All he was built for was turning up on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. That was what he was built for, and anything around that, I think, was too much to handle. And that's again one of the sort of the great fascinations of his story. He's not, you know, you look at Cristiano Ronaldo, who's completely dedicated to his craft and he's sculpting his body at every possible moment that he's got. You know, there's no sort of shenanigans of that kind from Cristiano Ronaldo. And he's a magnificent footballer and had an amazing career. And yet, there's something inhuman about Cristiano Ronaldo. And I don't mean that nastily, but he's turned himself into a machine almost, hasn't he? And George Best was about as human and frail as you could get. And I personally, there's a lot about that that is attractive. You know, you see it in rock stars and whatever, and I think that's one of those things that would drive anybody who actually worked with him and relied on him absolutely mental. But from the outside looking in, you know, that being human is something again that elevates him onto that iconic pedestal, I think.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think, you know, a lot of iconic sports people have that frailty. I mean, you mentioned Gazza, which is a good example. And obviously, you know, outside of football, Alex Higgins perhaps was another example. And there's always a comparison that I sort of think about when you look at Messi and Maradona. Messi is admired by all Argentinian football fans. Maradona's loved.
Yeah.
And I think there's a, you know, it seems like a bit of a sort of strange comparison, but I think that's true because with Maradona, he's almost one of their own. You know, you could see, you know, he's a kid from the back streets, and Best was a kid from Belfast, and Gascoigne was sort of very coming from working class. And I think it gives you a kinship, doesn't it? An ability to love them, as well as admire them. So, great. So I guess with football, with iconic sports people in any sport, but particularly with football, there's always a possibility that they sort of influence things away from the pitch. I mean, in later life, he became a bit of a TV celebrity on doing Sky punditry and that sort of thing, and various sort of things. I think he did tours with Rodney Marsh as well. But outside of football, even when he was playing, he was a big character, wasn't he?
He was the first footballer that they were doing lifestyle documentaries about, and he got this, you know, space age house in the middle of, I don't know where it was, but, you know, and people were showing it. There were always films of him filling up pyramids of champagne glasses and opening boutiques. And I remember one, I don't know, something like Nationwide or something like that, went to the George Best fan club, and there were these huge sacks of mail, you know, about 20 sacks of mail sitting there waiting to be answered. And, you know, there was a George Best fan club. That changed, as I say, it changed footballers, it changed, you know, you think sort of 3-4 years later, Kevin Keegan comes along, and Kevin Keegan does the same thing, but Kevin Keegan does it sober. And, you know, he builds the Kevin Keegan brand in the same way that George Best did. George Best had no idea what he was doing. He just happened to be a brand, didn't he? And, yeah, then, you know, guys like Kevin Keegan and, you know, all those who came later on, they could see, well, they could see his mistakes, obviously, but they could also see the potential of what he'd done and who he was, and they built on that. So I think there was a lot of change came that way, and I think it did change football in the sense that he was a person that people who didn't like football knew about, and there's not been that many of them. I mean, you know, Stanley Matthews earlier on, but he transcended football. People were interested in him because he was George Best, not just because he played for Manchester United, and that was quite a newish sort of thing within football, and it moved it down a different sort of channel, and it, you know, started the process of football becoming, you know, more than just a bloke thing that you did on a Saturday afternoon. It became, you know, obviously, I mean, the way he looked, he got, you know, he was sort of mobbed in the same way that the Beatles were by girls and stuff. So that opened up a different audience. It got other people, you know, got them interested, and that changed the makeup of you know, the attendances and stuff. So in that sense, I mean, he was beginning something that we're only sort of now really seeing the full benefits of, you know, with more women coming to games, more families coming to games. I suppose he started a lot of that just because he transcended everything. You know, he was, I keep coming back to the Beatles, but it was like Paul McCartney and John Lennon. He was as important as that to everybody. Everybody knew. You know, if George Best had given a concert on the rooftop of Apple and Savile Row, it would have been exactly the same as it is in Get Back underneath. There would be people underneath staring up, oh God, it's George Best. That's how it would have been, you know. So in a way, he was bigger than football, really, which is a bizarre thing. And, yeah, I remember years later, 1974, I mean, what would he have been? He's still probably 31, 32. And Jeff Astor was having his testimonial at the Albion, and George had had one of his periods out of the game. And he came and guested for the Albion side for Jeff Astor. And he was about 2 stone overweight. He hadn't played anymore. And he was the best player on the pitch by a mile. You know, he was just mesmerising. And that never really left him all the way through. But unfortunately, if you're going to play at the top level, you can't be 2 stone overweight even then. So it all, I don't know. People, yeah, that thing, you know, that story you told about where did it all go wrong. And people say, yeah, all of that unfulfilled potential and, you know, he should have been this, he should have been that. But he was George Best. How much more do you want? You know, he, without all those other things, he's not George Best.
No, it's true. You know? Yeah.
So I think, you know, the whole story, it's just a great story in all its, you know, successes and failures and laughs and tragedies and all of that. It's you know.
It's interesting you mentioned, I mean, I guess, you know, to some extent you can say, I mean, I mentioned the players in the past, like, you know, I say Maradona and Gascoigne. It's almost that living on the edge that gives them that edge as well, you know, that sort of, that maverick thing as you described it. But you might have, you mentioned something a little bit, just a few seconds ago, about him being bigger than football. And I know exactly what you mean, because he almost transformed football. It became like a pop art thing as well as being football. It became, you know, acceptable in different spheres. And as you say, it took it away from the bloke with a flat cap sort of image to a more, you know, swinging 60s image, didn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yeah, he was like an art installation, really, I suppose, wasn't he? I mean, and that again, you know, I mean, we live in a different world now, and broadly speaking, I think, for the better, but in the sense of, you know, we expect better behaviour from people and all of that. Equally, you know, people have their demons, and, you know, we're always saying at the same time, be kind, except when somebody does something that you don't like, and then we all descend upon them with axes. I mean, it's a Yeah, people sometimes they want to use the current phrase, cancel George Best because of all the things that he did off the pitch. And I don't know. You wouldn't necessarily wanted to be around George Best at certain points in his life because he was, would destruct it. Equally, he was in the hands of an illness that was, eating away at him. So, you have to take that into consideration. And equally, for those of us, I will doubtless be criticised for this, but for those of us who aren't actually in the room with these people, can we just not enjoy their art? Because if we're going to say that anybody who we're going to put up there as an icon has to be a perfect human being, there ain't going to be no icons. Because, all of us have got, various demons. We've all done terrible things at times that we're not proud of and had terrible things done to us that we don't like. I think all the stuff that George Best did, I just wanted to think of the football, really, And I know it's a modern sort of thing to chip away at that legacy, and I understand why. But I think, we'll have to take down all Picasso's paintings, won't we? we're going to have to burn pretty well every film that's ever been made, and I don't know. That's a digression.
No, I think you're really on right on message there, mate. I mean, as you say, there's so many sort of great icons in many walks of life. I mean, Van Gogh cut part of his ear off. I mean, there you go. That's hardly sort of middle of the road behaviour. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting just sort of we talk about how he sort of changed football. And you look at a lot of players who followed him and you wonder would they have been in that situation where without George Best, I'm thinking of people like Frank Worthington, Ronnie Marsh, Stanley Bowles, Alan Hudson. I mean, all these sort of maverick players that, fans of that club where these players look on these players as, I mentioned Frank Worthington, probably scored the best goal I've ever seen in my life when he's playing for, I think, Bolton, when he did that sort of 1-2-3 over his head and volleyed it away. And Terry Butcher apparently said to us, that was a great goal. And Worthington said, should have been sitting up in the stand, you had a better view of it, rather than Mark trying to mark him. I mean, that's Derek, you don't know if it's true, but you can see it happening, can't you? You can see him saying it, because this is the thing, the best iconography almost allowed to flourish after him.
I think you're right. I think because all of those players that you mentioned, fantastic players, but they weren't as good as George Best. And if they'd been the first one, would they have been indulged? Or would it have been, he's good 3 times out of 10. But we
can't afford the luxury player.
Exactly that. The luxury player, the bane of English football. But because George Best had done what he'd done, I think there was a lot more tolerance for Stan Bowles. There was a lot more tolerance for Frank Worthington and, whoever it was at your club. Because everybody then wanted a George Best, obviously.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't you? Not that there were any more left. But I think he created an opening in the culture. Yeah, I mean, let's remember, this is, he comes through in the 60s when Alf Ramsey is turning football into very much a getting rid of the wingers, and it's very much about winning and winning and winning, and it's about the team ethic, and it's about doing your job and all that kind of stuff, which, a lot of clubs have sort of went and followed that pattern. And then, you've got the coaching, Don Howe and people like that coming in and regimenting things a little bit successfully, but regimenting things. And then you've got George Best doing what George Best wants to do. And I think without that, it would have been in the 70s very difficult for Stan Bowles and Worthington and Marsh and whoever they are to have had that opportunity.
And I guess if you're a fan, if you're going to watch a Don Howe team bring out a 1-0 victory, or do you want to go and watch George Best play? There ain't no choice, is there? I mean, I sort of linking on to that, I guess, perhaps one of the last questions is, there again, it is probably an easy answer, but how is Best remembered, by players and fans and football historians? Do they all look at him the same way, or are there differences, do you think, from where people's viewpoint is?
I think there are a lot of differences. As we said earlier, I think a lot of people can't see beyond the fact that he wasn't a perfect human being. And there was a lot of stuff, particularly, about when he had the liver transplant and then went back drinking again. And, I can understand why everybody was livid about that kind of thing. It's natural to be angry about that. But, again, he was in the grip of a disease and you are what you are, aren't you? I think within the football community, the people who just want to talk about the football, I mean, he's universally loved, isn't he? Maybe, perhaps not Manchester City or Liverpool, I don't know. But I think even there, you know, there was nothing in English football like watching George Best in his pomp, just gliding across, you know, as you say, the ploughed fields with the onions in them. I mean, he was just—he was unstoppable. I would go as far as up to Messi. Nobody has had the balance that George Best had got. Once he was in flight, nothing could knock him off the ball. You know, you could lunge at him. You know, this is the days of the tackle from behind when it was compulsory, outlawed. Yeah, yeah. You know, a physical game on lousy surfaces for much of the season. Anybody who saw that and anybody who's seen the video clips and stuff afterwards, you have to love George Best. There's no getting away from it. I mean, he is the greatest footballer that the United Kingdom has produced. You know, and I nobody comes close. You know, Bobby Charlton, Dennis Law, Kenny Dalglish, you know, whoever's playing now, Wayne Rooney, whoever it is, they ain't George Best. They're not George Best as a player, and they're not George Best as a figure either. You know, I mean, he was everything, wasn't he? You know, he was Paul McCartney.
I hope there's people listening to us. Well, I hope they are, otherwise I've just moved you and Richard Dave, which is fair enough anyway. But I mean, if anybody's listening to us who sort of can't remember George Best in his prime, get them up on YouTube, guys. I mean, there's so many videos, and you'll think, wow, you know, this is a guy who, you know, had the same sort of time abilities as Messi, as Maradona, as Cruyff, as, you know, got some talents. And I guess the final question, Dave, is, and I know this is a simple three-letter, one-word answer to this, but perhaps you can sort of tell me why. If they play today, how would they fit into the modern game? Would they still be a star? Yes. Yes.
Sure. You'd never have heard of Cristiano Ronaldo, I'll tell you that. I mean seriously, the Ballon d'Or, you know, that Messi and Ronaldo have monopolised for, what was it, 10 years or whatever it was, 12 years. George Best would have won the lot, wouldn't he? Yeah, I mean, it is such a different game, and yet he was playing modern football in a different setting, as we've said, you know, a physical setting. The tackling was different. The pitches were terrible by and large. You know, you look at every game that's played now, certainly at that top level, that elite level, the pitches are absolutely perfect. You know, the ball runs true, you're not falling over. So, I mean, putting him on that surface and nobody can kick him from behind, I don't know how you would possibly stop George Best. You know, there would be no way.
It's fascinating to think, you know, Best in his prime now, early 20s, mid-20s, George Best now, would he be regarded? Now, we've got the sort of global television audience, and you know, the world will see it rather than just perhaps the UK seen in the 60s and early 70s. Would he be considered to be arguably the best in the world of all time?
He'd have to be very, very close. You talk about Best and you talk about Pelé in the same breath, and you talk about Maradona in the same breath. I mean, you can't get any higher than that, really, can you? You know, I mean, that is the absolute pinnacle. Cruyff in the same breath. He's one of those sort of four or five that you will always say, yes, they are the greatest of all time. And he will always be in that conversation. The only downside of George Best's entire career was Northern Ireland not qualifying for a World Cup. Yeah, and that was a great shame, but really nothing much to do with him. Yeah, he won a European Cup. He won the league title and all of that. So he showed it on the biggest stage. And he's one of those. He's up there with Pelé and Cruyff and Maradona. And that's your route, your Mount Rushmore to move on to another podcast.
I guess, you know, when we sort of spoke about doing this series on icons, I mean, if nobody picked George Best, I'd have been gutted. Okay, so massive thanks to Dave for sharing his thoughts on the icon that is George Best. And in the rest of the series, if anybody comes up with a better icon than George Best, good God, that's going to be worth listening to. So thanks for listening, and catch us again on the next episode of LOD Podcast from These Football Times.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.